ago. We used to get our food homegrown, and toothpaste used to make you smile. It used to be you'd shop with ease, never eating antifreeze. You plan to keep on living by a while. But now our goods are all delivered from somewhere on the Yangtze River. No one knows the source there, so you might find some horsehair. But if corporations make a buck, they don't give a flying. Peking duck. And with this system we get stuck today, it makes you sigh. Now when you buy an American pie, your grandma didn't bake it, it was made in Shanghai, where they engineered the apples to be juicy, not dry. But the crust is made of cardboard and lime. Don't feed it to your dog, he might die. Now, did you eat a tasty cake, and did it make your stomach ache? I could have said I told you so. And the reason you are looking wrong is some guy took bribes in Szechuan, so you just bit into Little Debbie's toe. And now the toys you bought from Fisher Price have toxins deemed unsafe for mice, and Elmo tends to wheeze. I'll be placed with pigeons. With tar and you will see that I'll buy from some young guy. I'd rather sit and it's heavy, but the price is too high. Soon $20 will buy a car from Shanghai. And honey, that'll be the day we all die.
Yeah, that's right. That'll be the day we all die, man. Chomping on that Chinese stuff. It's crazy, man. Crazy. I'm going to run you a little funny but sad track, or send it to you, MP3, on the state of cigarette smoking around the world. How these tobacco companies, these all-American tobacco companies that love you so much, they finally got them stopped. But I'm telling you, they smoke like hell here in the Midwest. Yet they're paying what, $5-6 a pack of cigarettes? Unbelievable, man. So now they went to Asia. I never will forget way back in the early 90s when John and I were taken to Japan on a trip, speaking tour, and the hotel we stayed in was a very fine hotel. They had a big meeting hall there, convention center. And I remember being in the lobby at just about lunchtime, and the doors had opened. Hundreds of doctors, these were Japanese doctors, MDs, were there on some kind of a medical thing, coming out of there. And every one of them, the minute they got out of that room, lighted up. So there would be maybe 100 of them, these doctors, Japanese doctors, puffing like hell on cigarettes. I don't know whether they've cut their smoking down in Japan since then or not, but I'm telling you, they smoke that cigarette. And these predatory capitalist corporations know that. They love that. And now, of course, they're seeing China as their great receptacle of their poison. And I'm not telling people, you know, don't smoke. Well, I am. I'm suggesting they not smoke. Lone wolves that smoke, stop it. We need you. We need you around. And if you smoke too much, or if you smoke much at all, you're not going to be around for the big fight. Yeah. This is White Aryan Resistance, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations for our daily radio show. And I think most of you got it in. And most of our lone wolves out there have got their donations in. And you can send your snail mail to that address. And always when you send a donation, put your email address on the material inside the envelope or inside the flap or something. And I wouldn't put your name and address on the outside of the envelope, because I get all my mail. I've never had any problem in 30, 40 years getting my mail. The U.S. Post Office is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most efficient parts of the government, and also a great employee of thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of white people. And we need to protect that post office, because there's people who want to make it private. Well, what they do when they make it private, then they sell it off. Like over in England, where they 500-year institution of the post office, they privatized it, and the people that bought it turned right around, sold it off, doubled their money, billions of dollars, and now they got half-ass mail in England. So anyhow, that's something to think about. And the post office in every little town employs quite a few people. And in my town, they're almost all white. They're 99% white. Well, I sent you out a picture of these guys in Ukraine, the EU Ukraine, troops carrying Israeli weapons. How about that? Isn't that interesting? Israeli weapons and neo-Nazis, alleged neo-Nazis, fighting on the same side, and the Jews all excited and fighting on the main government of Ukraine. What is it? It's a lot of insanity going on as far as I can see. Why would the so-called neo-Nazis come from Britain and France and all these white countries, where they have a big problem they need to solve there? They don't have to leave their country and go anyplace. They're out there trying to kill those Russian people in the east, and at the same time they're working directly with the CIA, with the EU, with the crooked corporations, with the Jews. It's becoming more insane by the hour in this world. I noticed, too, how they've destroyed all these countries, you know. They wanted regime change. They thought they'd make it better for the people, so we had regime change in Iraq. Totally unconstitutional, illegal, but they did it anyhow. And then what happened? Thousands of our people got killed playing war games. Hundreds of thousands of their people got killed, so they had regime change, and then the government's been for shit ever since. Then you had, now you got Syria trying to regime change there. You know, things are going to get better with no government, of course. They want to run the governments right out of the Pentagon and Wall Street. And then you got Gaddafi's. Gaddafi's gone. He ran a pretty stable government for North African values. The women were the highest educated women in the Middle East outside of Israel. And they had all kinds of regular, normal rights. But no, we had to get rid of Gaddafi. So we had regime change there, too. We even took advantage of a change in the weather pattern to set that one up, and probably had some kind of control mechanism to change the weather and turn it into a drought for 10 years, which led directly to the downfall of Gaddafi. Let's see, what? Oh, Egypt, too. We want regime change there, too. Strange. That was not quite as pure as the others, because there was more of a demand from the people in the streets for regime change in Egypt. But you know, never know how that worked out. I mean, the government's in shit shape now. So anyhow, what's all this regime change? In other words, get rid of the leaders of a country. Make it a fake civil war. Kill them all. Well, like I've told you before, my lady and I like to get out, take our dogs, and go out on Sunday afternoon and take in a movie. But the movies are getting worse and worse and worse in the theaters. They got all these crazy ass, mostly, you know, generated crap. And anyhow, they're terrible. Well, anyhow, I picked out one I thought would be funny, but still interesting. Kingsford or Kingsway or whatever it was. And for a little while, it was really funny and interesting. But then, about the middle of the show, it went totally to shit. And believe it or not, they made a comedy out of hundreds of people's heads blowing off. And everybody's... And the theater was full of these screaming, meme-y white people, laughing and cheering as all these people were having their heads blown off. And I thought, Jesus Christ, what does the white race come to? A bunch of predator killer thinkers and so forth like that. So that movie is so bad in its connotations and what it the idea it gives to the people, that if ISIS will get a copy of that film and show it to all their training sessions, they will be twice as dangerous and hate the United States even more than they do already. And they'll be cutting more heads off because they say, look at that. The U.S. blows people's heads off by the hundreds, by the thousands. So that movie must have been thought up by some sick-ass, really sick-ass Jew or a non-Jew. And I hope it doesn't make any money, but if I were with ISIS, I'd get a copy of it right away and send it to them for training their people of what rats the American people and the American film industry have become. And even though we get cheap seats, being senior citizens, that's even too much, movies like that. Well, I got a note from a young man from Ireland, in Dublin. He reports for a newspaper called the University Observer. He wants to do an interview with me, and I emailed him back and told him, come on down, give me a call, and we'll see what we can do. Well, I got a note from one of our old-time lone wolves. Spent a week in Miami for work recently. What a racial mess it is down there. Heard more Spanish speaking than here in Southern California. I think the only white people I saw were Jews. Glad to be back. All is well here. There you go. Jeez. Yeah, my gal and I had thought of maybe getting a few days off during the winter and going down, maybe going to Florida, but I'm not going to go to Florida. Have to be someplace else that's a little warmer. But that is a sick place and getting sicker all the time unless you're living inside gated communities. Well, let's do a little educating on the subject of Negroes in the United States. This is from the book I told you about, The Cult of Equality, which is an exceptional book. However, it was printed in 1945. There's been a lot of changes since then. But the Negroes in the world have not changed that much. Although we have seen that there are only two countries in the world which are peopled and governed by Negroes, in the United States there are certain cities and large Negro populations which, while they do not govern themselves politically, since Negroes are minority groups in their respective cities and states whose governments are controlled by the white race, or they have been, and still do somewhat, you know. Yet economically and socially they do govern themselves. In spite of all their pleas to the contrary, they are masters of their own destiny, which I don't think they've evolved to figure out yet. They're waiting on Whitey to take care of it for them, or a majority do. Let us now see what the Negroes have achieved in the United States, particularly in those cities where they are numerous and where they have had a greater opportunity to succeed because of better educational advantages and improved economic status. The city of New Orleans, Louisiana, with about 160,000 Negroes at that time, attracted our attention because its Negro population has always been large compared to the white. It was for over 100 years a slave market, and throughout the years many of its Negroes were free men of color. And today there is a greater proportion of mulattoes, or lighter colored Negroes, than is usually found in most cities. And as far as Tom Metzger is concerned, these mulattoes have grown exponentially, and they are the danger, the real, real danger to the race. There are several reasons for the large mulatto population of New Orleans. First, the city was founded and settled by the French and later by the Spaniards, neither of whom entertained the same feeling against racial intermixing as did the Anglo-Saxon people. In 1788, there were 1,500 gens de couleur libres in New Orleans, whatever that means, I guess. But even then, they aroused antagonism. I guess they're talking about in French Negroes. An ordinance forbade the women of that class to wear jewels or plumes, and they were compelled, when appearing in public, to cover their heads with a cloth called a tignon. During and after the revolution in Santo Domingo, thousands of people came to New Orleans by way of Cuba, and many of these were mulattoes. George W. Cable estimated that in 1809 there were 2,000 free people of color. He says they were an uninspiring, corrupted, feeble class of which little was feared and nothing hoped. Here's footnotes. In New York and Chicago, Negroes voted as a block, sometimes hold the balance of power. You see, they learned well that they better get a block vote. And this political power is not inconsiderable, since the Negro vote often determines the results in a municipal or state election, and may even exert a profound influence on the result of national elections. And that was in 1945. Here's another footnote. This term at first was applied only to mulattoes or Negroes with some white blood. The term colored person or colored people originated in Louisiana. It is now a euphemism for Negro. On the 18th of July, 1809, nearly the same number of free persons of color originally from Santo Domingo arrived from Cuba. Governor Claiborne ordered the deportation of these people, but not many left the city. The further entrance of these lighter-skinned Negroes was soon prohibited, but not before quite a number had added to the already comparatively large population of lighter-skinned Negroes. In 1810, the population of New Orleans was 24,552, of which 4,000 were free persons of color. New Orleans, being a city and slave market, was a favorable locality for the practice of miscegenation. And 125 years ago, a strange custom which existed in no other city in the United States, and which we do not like to think about now, resulted in the increase of the mulatto population. The same custom, called mansabia in Brazil, is still prevalent in Bahai. The well-to-do young men form a temporary alliance with a quadroon or octoroon, furnishing her with a house and paying all the expenses of the establishment, which arrangement lasts until the man terminates it for marriage or for other reasons. Before the Civil War, the mulatto population of New Orleans was much larger than it is now in proportion to the Negro population. The mulattoes comprised four-fifths of the FMCs in 1840. The free mulattoes were nearly one-third as numerous as the whites. Considerable feeling against them developed, and between the 40s and 50s, a migration of mulattoes occurred in which, according George W. Cable, about 12,000 mulattoes moved away from the city. Where they went or what happened to them, nobody knows. Thus, at the same time the Civil War, the free mulatto population of the city had been considerably reduced. Many of the mulattoes, who were free men of color, owned slaves, and some were persons of wealth. In fact, P.F. de Courtenay, in Lippincott's Magazine, 1894, stated that in fact P.F. de Gourney stated that in 1860 the free people of color owned one-fifth of the taxable property in the city of New Orleans. In 1850, in New York City, according to the census, there were 65 persons among the free colored who were engaged in occupations requiring education, such as doctors, lawyers, merchants, ministers, printers, students, teachers, druggists, and clerks. This is one out of every 55 free persons of color. In New Orleans, there were 165 persons engaged in such occupations, or one out of every 11 free persons of color. Of those with education, one-third were mulattoes. When General Butler was in the city during the war, he was entertained by a group of Negroes, and at the banquet, gold and silver plate was used. He was impressed with their culture and refinement and other evidences of wealth. What has happened to the men of affairs among these colored people? They were not subjected to the same hardships as were the white citizens of New Orleans. They were not despoiled of their property. On the contrary, they were more or less protected by the federal government along with the newly freed Negroes, and they should have been able to hold on to their wealth. But today we do not know of many Negroes in New Orleans who are wealthy. It is true that some moved away, many going to France to live, but most of them stayed here where their descendants still live. While the American or Anglo-Saxon portions of its people might have shown strong race prejudice, the Creole portion of the population of New Orleans were more kindly and more considerate of the mulatto people. The article in Lippincott's Magazine already mentioned tells of the strange social group, the Creole mulattoes, above the Negroes with whom they would not associate, and yet who were unacceptable socially to white people. The Creoles treated this mulatto group with consideration without accepting them socially. They transacted business with them, as some were brokers, merchants, real estate agents, and tailors. Well, let me tell you a story. When I went down to New Orleans, or Baton Rouge, to work with David Duke on his campaign for state senator, this was on down to New Orleans in Metairie, Louisiana, where the Duke had his headquarters. And so, being that I was operational and operating a lot of his campaign, we went all around the town together. And I remember him taking me into one bar where the bartender, or maybe the bar owner, was He was evidently a member of the Klan, and that man was so dark, it was unbelievable. He was dark. He had these Creole features, and evidently Duke used to recruit a lot of these kind of people, because I argued with him about it. I said, these are not white people. He laughed at me and said, oh yeah, well, they pay their dues. Yeah. In view of the fact that many of these mulattoes possessed financial means, they were not handicapped economically as Negroes claim to be now. They could have started manufacturing industries, promoted banks and insurance companies, and ventured on some of the innumerable enterprises that white people undertake in a growing city. That the mulattoes did not do this under the most favorable circumstances shows their lack of progressiveness. It is one of the failings of the Negro people, or of those possessing Negro blood. Negroes and mulattoes have been in New Orleans over 200 years. During that time, they have enjoyed, and for a period of over 75 years, some of them had education, the wealth, and more social freedom than was found in any other American city. Yet they have reproduced no writers, artists, industrialists, or professional men. They have instituted no program that would help lift their race to higher levels of culture. Today, instead of owning one-fifth of the taxable property, the colored people of the city, numbering 30.1% of the population, own only 3.4% of the dwellings of the city. In 1940, 4,522 dwellings out of 132,803. It seems difficult for Negroes to make a success of the enterprise they start. In southern cities, the Negro professional man cannot easily obtain satisfactory offices downtown. The leading office buildings will not rent them space. So about 15 years ago, a group of prominent Negro citizens, in cooperation with the local Negro life insurance companies, erected a 10-story office building downtown New Orleans. On one of the streets in the Negro trading section, a part of it was occupied by the Knights of Pythias, a fraternal organization, another section by life insurance company, and there was even a roof garden on the top. Space was rented to leading Negro physicians and lawyers. Soon, however, the owners of the building began to become delinquent on their notes, and it was finally sold under a mortgage foreclosure and is now passed into the hands of white people. The Higgins Industries, manufacturers of Higgins boats, used it for their colored personnel department training schools. It would not be fair to say that the failure of these large offline building owned by Negroes in the South's largest city was due entirely to its management, because many other office buildings had gotten into financial difficulties, even the Empire State Building in New York City. On the other hand, office buildings in New Orleans, which were properly financed and properly managed, did not have their mortgages foreclosed. They have proved to be good investments. It would seem that in a city where there are 150,000 colored people, an office building such as the Pythias Temple, about which I am writing, would be a successful real estate venture. In the whole United States, the Negroes own few buildings, and even in Harlem, where they are nearly a half million people, thousands of stores and other mercantile establishments, there is no Negro-owned office building. Okay, let's get back at it here. The statement that Negroes in the United States have been denied economic opportunity is untrue. It is true that in many instances, because of racial prejudice, their economic opportunities are often not equal to those of whites. For instance, if a Negro applied for a job at the same time as a white man, the preferences would probably be given to the white man But even this statement can be qualified because many times for certain kinds of work, employers would prefer Negro laborers and hire them in preference to white men at, of course, a lesser amount of pay. Let us look now into the general proposition that the reason Negroes are poverty-stricken as a race is that opportunity of making money has been denied them. Upon analysis of this theory, it seemed to be unsound. In the first place, while money is not the greatest desiderium in life, yet it comes close to being the dominant psychological force in the world. Next to hunger and sex, love of money is the most powerful incentive that urges men to action. The power of money is so great that the Bible says the love of money is the root of all evil. Well, I agree for the most part on that. The possession of money brings power to the owner and respect from everyone. Call a man a millionaire and he immediately has the respect of the crowd. While most Southern people will not condescend to show any social favors to a Negro millionaire, yet they will not go out of their way to offend him. And a Negro millionaire living in the South, if there are any such, would not find his way hard or his life difficult. He would find that he could go to the bank and be received courteously and with consideration, that the shopkeepers would be glad to wait upon him and do business with him. The same attitude obtains towards Christians or Negroes owning less. A Negro farmer, for instance, who owns his own land is not browbeaten or mistreated by his neighbors or by businessmen in the town and the city where he deals. But of course, some Negro landowners, just as some white landowners, are unpopular, but that the resentment arises from the fact of property ownership is to be doubted. There is always present the ordinary resentment which shiftless and ignorant people hold in general against those who have accumulated wealth. Well, I'm not against people accumulating wealth if they use their wealth honestly and they're not corrupt and they do what they can for their race. Americans think too much of money and property to try to prevent a Negro from accumulating it. The kind of people that the Americans do not like, or to put it more harshly, have no time for, are those who are shiftless and poor. This is one reason why Negroes are not popular. But let a man start making money, then his neighbors begin to think more of him. Americans admire success. For this reason, Southern people, no more than Northern people, have not tried to prevent Negroes from making money. Southerners might not want money Negroes to build their houses in the same community residential sections, but this is a social and not an economic limitation. Southern white people, as do Northern white people, live by farming, manufacturing, and trading. Southern people have traded with Negroes, that is to say, exchanged produce, commodities, and merchandise for cash. They have financed them and done business with them throughout the years. And, of course, that was, in my estimation, the whole idea was a mistake. It should have never happened, period. They could have made money in Africa if they had the brains. Okay. This was a statement by Booker T. Washington. Wherever I have seen a black man who was succeeding in his business, who was a taxpayer, and who possessed intelligence and high character, that individual was treated with the highest respect by members of the white race. In proportion as we can multiply these examples, north and south, our problem will be solved. Booker T. Washington, who was totally antithetic to the position of Martin Luther King, of course. Martin Luther King falsely thought and preached that to raise the entire race, which is not going to happen, and it's never going to happen. no matter how they screw things up. The reason the South has paid its Negro labor such low wages is the inefficiency and unreliability of his labor. It is true that under proper regimentation and organization, better work might be obtained from the colored laboring man. But generally speaking, the mass of Negro laborers in the South, while seemingly underpaid, are really not worth any more than they're paid. Assume that, and that goes for the Mexicans too. Like a trucker told me, it takes five Mexicans to unload a trailer. It takes them twice as long as one or two white men. Assume that a Negro does not get paid as much as a white man for the same kind of work. He can still lift himself up by the bootstraps if he has a mind to. In the first place, his wants are simpler and does not cost him as much to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. But whether he starts to work for a dollar a day or 75 cents a day, these figures are somewhat astonishing since they represent hourly wages in these times, does not make much difference. Looking into the histories of our great merchant princes, industrialists, and financiers, we find that most of them began their business careers at even smaller salaries. Andrew Carnegie, the immigrant boy from Scotland, started at $3 a week. John Wanamaker, the clerk, at $3.50 a week, worked from 7 in the morning until 10 at night. Frank Vanderlip of the National Bank worked in the steel mills for 75 cents a day. But these men did not stop there. Well, I worked for 75 cents an hour when I was a kid, and I was glad to get it. How then did they achieve their success? They saved their money. The savings, of course, could not have been greater since they were out of their own apprenticeships. They worked long hours, and they often denied themselves the necessities of life. But ambition backed by determination, not by a few weeks or months, but for a long, weary years, finally forced them to the top. The sharecropper and tenant system in the South has been denounced as being almost feudal. Well, I believe it was. Many claim that this economic system should be done away with as soon as possible. I believe it should have been. And yet the same sharecropper tenant system, strange as it may seem, has afforded economic opportunity to Negroes throughout the South. But because of inherent racial characteristics, with few exceptions, they have not been able to take advantage of it. I'm not defending the injustices and unfairness and the wrongs of sharecropping, but it has offered to Southern Negroes as well as white people an opportunity. Yeah, well, to a degree you're right, but it was almost like a form of slavery, because I traveled in the South with my parents as a kid, and I saw myself exactly how the tenant-farmer situation worked. It was sort of like the company store. The big landowners operated like you had a company store, and they'd loan you money, then when you bring the crops in, they take all the profit. And at that time, even in the 40s, if you tried to run and leave, they'd send a sheriff after you and bring you back, whether you were white or black. Any barefoot Negro who looks able-bodied can walk into the office of the Southern landowner and, unless he is a known criminal, come out with a contract by which he is leased 20 acres and a mule, with the agreement that the planter is to see that he and his family and the mule are fed for nearly a whole year until the crop comes in. The landowner makes a good profit, provided the crop does come in and enough cotton is made and picked to pay off the debt. But many things can happen. A Negro tenant might die, he might be killed in a brawl on Saturday night, or he might become sick and totally disabled in the middle of the crop year. He might run away, or what is more probable, he might prove to be a poor worker or indifferent farmer. And when settling up times come, his account will show that he owes the property owner money. Should the cropper care to leave, then there is no way of collecting it. Well, there is too, because I know they used to send a sheriff after him and catch him, bring him back, and if they caught him. In all fairness to these tenants and croppers, however, most of them pay their debts. This fellow who wrote this book, it's a good book, but he tends to be on the property class side a little bit more than I would appreciate. He glosses over some very glaring examples of the rich against the poor. Now, in this kind of farming, there are three contingencies. A small crop might result in showing a loss for the year's operation and leaving the tenant in debt, or the proceeds of the crop might be enough to bring him out even. The third possibility is that on his 20 acres of land, after working for a year, the cropper might earn a net profit of, say, $100. When compared to the annual profits of Standard Oil Company, this is no great sum of money, but of 35 million families in the United States, how many of them have $100 in cash at the end of the year when all expenses have been paid? The answer is very few indeed. So that the tenant who paid, the answer is very few indeed. So that the tenant who earns a living for himself and his family gets his housing, food, and his clothes and still has $100 after a year's effort has not done so badly. Well, if he has a profit on the cotton or whatever, what will he do with the $100 is an important question. Andrew Carnegie would hang on to that $100. He would put it into a bank, or if a bank were inconvenient, he would guard it very carefully. And if he were a sharecropper, the next year, instead of taking up his rations and supplies at the plantation commissaries, he would pay cash for those supplies, obtaining them at a much lower cost. The $100 might be enough to pay for all of his second year's supplies, but it would go a long way towards doing so. When the end of the second year comes, according to the crop to be normal one, instead of owing his landlord $200 for supplies, he would owe, say, $50. When he settled up, instead of receiving $100, he would get $250 cash. For this third year's operations, he now has enough cash to finance himself. The tenant is on the way to making money. At the end of the 5 or 10 years, allowing for some bad crop years, he would have accumulated enough money to buy a small piece of property or to make a substantial payment on a farm of his own. Well, let's see, let's go on, skip a little bit here. This is getting too... White laborers and farmers in the United States in the early part of the 19th century did not have an easy time. The history of the American pioneers is one of struggle. Schools were few and most people were illiterate. Many would go to the taverns to learn how to read by studying the well-worn newspapers available there. In Sandburg's Life of Lincoln, we get some idea of the almost primitive life of the people of Illinois. Lincoln was born and spent his early childhood in this backwoods country. I think with Chicago, it's still backwoods. He learned to read by the light of his open fireplace. But so great was his ambition and his determination that he rose to become the President of the United States, and probably a lot of some corruption along the way. He was one of the greatest characters in all history. I think that is nonsense. He overcame his environment. From the dreary background of American pioneer life came the builders of America and the creators of her civilization. Whose fault it is that Negroes have not contributed a greater share? At the time of the Civil War, there were nearly 500,000 free Negroes in the United States, 250,000 of whom were in the South, and two-fifths of their adults were able to read and write. Many of the Negroes owned much property, and some were wealthy. To prove that it was possible for a colored man to achieve success in this land of opportunity, we have only to glance at the career of Booker T. Washington. His book, Up From Slavery, one of the really great biographies, shows how his determination and ambition brought him success in spite of his handicaps of race and previous conditions of servitude. But we got to remember, that's a tiny minority of the black race. I'm sure you go down there to Africa, you're going to find some sharp Negroes, but most are not sharp. Negroes in the United States have failed to take advantage of their opportunities. Instead of blaming the white people for holding them down, they should have worked hard, saved their money, and improved their morals, and now they would by now have so much to wouldn't have so much to complain about. Harlem, on the northern end of Manhattan Island, in a sense of the largest Negro city in the world, in 1940 there were 458,440 Negroes in New York City, of whom over 400,000 lived in Harlem. With a concentrated, segregated Negro population, although without its own separate government or political officials, Harlem is in effect the Negro capital of the United States. Roy Oatley says it is the nerve center of advancing black America. Negroes, and now it's, I think it's a little bit in deterioration. Now it's Atlanta, Georgia. And if Detroit hadn't gone belly up, Detroit. Chicago also is a major spot for the Negro. Negroes have been in New York for a long time. In the year 1700, out of a total population of 15,000, one-fifth or 3,000 were Negroes. It is only recently that New York City's Negroes have been concentrated in Harlem. They have moved from one section to another. And while there is no legal barriers to their scattering throughout the city, there is a social one which was reinforced and controlled by the real estate market. When Negro tenants would move into certain sections, property values would decline in an alarming extent. Consequently, property owners would not sell their property to Negroes or encourage them to become tenants. Whenever Negroes moved into one section, the white people would move out. So for economic as well as racial reasons, the Negro in New York City have been grouped together. This should have been an advantage to them. A body of over 400,000 people should be self-sufficient economically, artistically, and socially. In Harlem, this proved to be so except economically. Roy Oatley, in his splendid book, The New World A-Comin', says that Harlem is not self-sufficient. Its people are dependent on the financial and commercial and industrial arteries of the dominant white groups for its very lifeblood. The only business controlled by the Negroes in Harlem are the beauty shops, cabarets, and mortuary parlors. The banks, stores, office building, apartments, and such few industries as are to be found there are owned and conducted by white people. Of course, Negro doctors and lawyers and professional men practiced among the Harlemites. Negro artists, actors, and writers make Harlem their home. Harlem today, this was 1945, is composed of the descendants of the early New York Negroes, thousands of those who have migrated from other sections, particularly the South, and over 100,000 who have come from the West Indies. Of these, in 1940, 51,000 were foreign-born, only 18,000 of whom have been naturalized. Harlem is the home of the brains of the Negro race in the United States, and yet its people are poor, diseased, live in crowded tenements, and are unable to lift themselves out of the mire. Although many of their race are well-to-do and some are rich, they never seem to start or promote business enterprises which would make them independent of the white race, which so many seem to hate. They show no community spirit except in their complaints against the things they are in, their efforts to gain social equality. Harlem cannot be cited as an example of a successful community organization promoted and conducted by the Negro race. Okay, there's I'm going to skip some of this. Okay, let's go to Bahia. Bahia is a state in Brazil, somewhat larger than the state of Texas in the United States. It has a population of approximately 4 million people, or 10% of the entire country of Brazil. In Bahia, the city of Bahia, now called San Salvador. Its population in 1940 was 368,726. The number of telephones in the city was 3,855, and the number of automobiles was 1,028. Bahia is interesting because it's one of the oldest cities in the Western Hemisphere and one where there has occurred the greatest intermixing of the black and the white races. Donald Pearson, in his recent book, Negroes in Brazil, that was from Chicago Press, writes of civilization, culture, and intermixion of races in Bahia. The title of the book means Brazil, but since the northern part of Brazil contains more Negroes and more half-breeds than any other section, since Bahia was a port of disembarkation for the majority of the millions of slaves which were brought to Brazil, and since many of them were used on plantations of that state, his study was wisely limited to the particular section. It is interesting to note that on the jacket of his book we find the description, quote, a revealing study of racial integration through economic mixture in a friendly land where class, not race, determines social prestige. Bahia was established in 1509 and is one of the oldest cities founded by Europeans in the Americas. From 1580 until 1680, it was a great port, one of the richest cities in the world. The state of Bahia was the home of great sugar plantations, so that the city of Bahia was a sugar market and an export port. That was bad. All sugar is a poison. It was also the leading port of the importation of slaves. In fact, Bahia was, until 1825, the first commercial city of Brazil. From the very beginning, there was interbreeding between the races. There was some mixing with the Indians, but most of the racial intermixing occurred between the Portuguese whites and the African blacks. The Portuguese did that all the time in Africa, too, when they were a big, powerful nation. In fact, they even encouraged whites and Negroes, because a lot of those people felt that by mixing up these and becoming octoroons, it would be easier to handle a population. Since in Brazil, people do not worry much about the color line, and in Bahia, particularly, there is no racial prejudice because of race per se. Mulattoes and those with Negro blood in their veins enjoy all the opportunities available to whites. For generations, mulattoes have owned property, and today the property in Bahia is owned by whites and mulattoes, and the society of the city of Bahia is composed of whites and mulattoes. But pure Negroes and dark-skinned mixed breeds own little property and do not have much social standing. In spite of this lack of racial antagonism, Bahia has not justified the expectations of those who believe that all races are equal. The Negroes there have not done as well as those in the United States. Pearson remarks, quote, individuals of African descent, mixed bloods as well as black, have risen in class more slowly than has the Negro in the United States. The city of Bahia had a head start on most cities of the New World, and yet today it is a sleepy, unprogressive city, its people possessing some wealth with a great deal of poverty among its darker-skinned citizens, many of whom are addicted to voodooism and other African cults. In Bahia, they even speak the old African languages, wear the same kind of clothes they did as their ancestors, and hold on to their religious beliefs in spite of the efforts of the Catholic Church to wipe them out. Here may be found sorcery, black magic, African dances, fetish cults, and the candomblé, with hundreds of deities, rituals, and fetishes. Bahia has developed few industrialists. His wealthy men never put up venture money except to buy slaves. While there is considerable culture in Baha'i today among the upper classes, many of whom go to Europe for their education, the city is backward from our standpoint. It has produced no predominant artists, musicians, or writers. For 300 years, it has been a great port, during 200 years of which it was one of the world's wealthiest cities. Yet its people have never invented any labor-saving devices, instituted social reforms to help their fellow human beings, develop the political programs that would bring about better government, or done anything that has added to the culture or to the improvement of mankind. In fact, so important is Baha'i in the world affairs that most people have never heard of it, or its modern name, San Salvador, and yet it is today among 300 largest cities in the world. In Baha'i, the Negroes have not been held down or deprived of their economic opportunities because there has been no class feeling between them or against them. Negroes have been in Brazil for over 400 years, and today many of them are still African in their customs and in their religion. They have progressed as very little distance from the civilization of their ancestors. Some of those who have become part of the white are now cultured and possess wealth, but as a people, they have been ineffective in national and international affairs. Surely the Negro race has had opportunity in Baha'i and has again failed to take advantage of it. Conclusion. After examining the countries, states, and cities where the Negro race has been dominant, or where a large enough group of the race is segregated so that in effect it is an independent community, the only conclusion we can come to is that Negroes have not proved that they can help develop a high-type civilization of their own. Okay, here. The Negro race has made its greatest progress in the United States, while we hear on all sides how Negroes are mistreated and deprived of their rights, how they are oppressed, and how they are denied opportunity. The fact is, the United States has been kind to the Negro and has afforded that race its greatest opportunity to succeed. In Brazil, where there are more Negroes than in any other country outside Africa, except the United States, where there is a little color prejudice and where there is a great natural wealth, Negroes have not done as well. In the United States, the Negro carried along by the general advance of the whites and the continued increment of wealth, although he often does little to help create wealth or to accumulate it, has automatically shared in the general prosperity. The United States gives the Negro splendid educational advantages, better than those enjoyed by peoples of many European countries. Even though his wages are slightly lower than those paid white laborers, they are far from above the wages received in Asia, Malaysia, Africa, and South America, and greater than the wages of the labor in Europe. In the skilled trades, such as carpenters, masons, and stevedores, wages are equal to those of white people and 100% above the wages of Europeans for similar work. While generally the Negro lives in poverty and in the cities, his habitation is often unsanitary, yet in the great charity hospitals, he receives the finest medical attention without charge. His health has improved as the general health of the country has improved. Thus, the Negro's mortality has decreased in the last decade from 16.5 per thousand to in 1930 to 13.9 in 1940. Economically, his condition is better than it ever has been. It might be interesting to glance at the history of the Negro in the United States and see what he has accomplished on his way up from slavery. One or two Negroes visited this country from the first Spanish explorers, but the first niggers to arrive in our country to become permanent residents were those 20 black men which the Dutch trading vessel, when it landed in Jamestown in 1619, sold to the Virginia planters. Negro slavery did not develop very fast in North America, provinces because its first slaves came by way of England. The exports of colonies were bulky, and the Negroes could be brought back as return cargo. To get them direct from Africa would have required a voyage to that coast, and there was little trading them between the North America and Africa. The slaves were imported in a roundabout way from England. In 1688, England stopped the export of slaves, and later that date they were brought to the colonies direct, or generally from the West Indies. Just how many Negroes were imported into this country during the early years of our history is not known. Bancroft, the historian, estimates, quote, previous to 1740, there may have been introduced into our country 130,000 Negroes. Before 1776, a few more than 300,000, unquote. And then it goes through two or three pages of statistics here. Okay, now we're going to pick up over here. The importation of slaves in the United States was abolished in 1808, but there has been some smuggling after that date. Owen estimated that in round figures, 500,000 slaves came to the United States. Slavery is one of society's oldest institutions, and it still exists in out-of-the-way places. In fact, slavery was one of the first steps towards civilization. Paradoxically, it was a beneficent institution. When primitive man engaged in wars, he killed and often ate his prisoners. But when he put his captives to work, instead of putting them to death, the institution of slavery became economical and socially advantageous to both victor and vanquished. The several purposes were accomplished. First, the life of the slave was saved. Second, he became valuable property, which encouraged the accumulation of wealth. And third, he was generally put to work tilling the soil, which fostered agriculture. Slavery has not always been meant hardship. The earlier Romans, for instance, treated their slaves as well, and in farming communities, they worked in the fields together with their master, ate at the table with him and his family. In the days of empire, however, the life of the slave was lightly regarded by the haughty Romans, and these poor wretches were often subjected to great cruelties, as when Vidius Pollio threw slaves to the Rhamphres in his fish pond to entertain his guests. Christianity brought about the decline of slavery in Europe in the Middle Ages, while the serfs were not much better off than the slaves. They belonged to the land and could not be separated from it. Their families could not be taken away and sold down the river. For 1,000 years, the institution of slavery did not exist in Europe except sporadically. It was against the law of the church and against Christian sentiment. But while Christianity had freed the slaves, it later manacled him again, for when the Portuguese began their voyages of discovery and brought back Negroes, it was proclaimed a Christian act because the souls of the poor pagans would otherwise have had been lost. This theory fitted in nicely with the trading instincts of both the Spaniards and the Portuguese, and soon, under the guise of Christianizing the savages, they enslaved Negroes and Indians by the millions. Under the yoke of gold-seeking Spaniards, the Indians died like flies in the Americans. Negroes were then imported to take their place, and while some survived, other millions died within a few years after their capture. And that's it for today, boys and girls. We're running out of time. And I'll be back with you tomorrow, Tuesday. Remember, 14:05. And I hope this reading helps you. And I'm sure a lot of people out there have suspicions of this information, that it's true. But to hear it from an expert, an author, who went the extra yard to write this book, I think we should pursue it. Got some very interesting things of which you can share with your children also. Ah! Ah!
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance Radio Network. Your host for today's show is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy.